Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Lance Thurner. Today, we'll be talking to Amanda Lynch and Siri Valand about their new book, Urgency in the Anthropocene, out this year by MIT Press. This is a fascinating and trenchant analysis of the core beliefs and ideas that motivate current political responses to global warming. Lynch and Valand examine how the ostensible state of constant urgency we live in is identified and addressed in political discourse. With detailed analyses of major climate accords and theories of geoengineering, they demonstrate how this discourse limits our imagined possibilities for sustainability. Instead, they propose an ethos of coexistence that is receptive to how different societies and cultures interpret catastrophe. A pluralistic approach to the Anthropocene, they suggest, may allow us to achieve environmental sustainability while honoring human dignity and justice. Amanda Lynch is Distinguished Professor of Environmental Studies at Brown University and the Director of the Institute at Brown for Environment and Society. Siri Valand is Senior Researcher at Nordland Research Institute in Bodø, Norway. Siri and Amanda, welcome to the show, and it's a wonderful opportunity here to talk to you about your new book, Urgency in the Anthropocene. To start off today's interview, could you tell me a little bit of how you came to this project and how you came to work on it together?
I guess I'll start, Siri, and then maybe you can correct me. I'd been thinking about a book that was bringing together a lot of the thoughts that I was having about the way the timescale of climate change was ramping up. And so I spent a short kind of semi-sabbatical putting together some thoughts about, you know, what that book might be like. And I submitted that to an editor just to get some feedback, and what surprised me was that the editor said, oh yes, I want this book, and let's do this right now. And I knew that I didn't have the capacity to do it right now, and so I turned to Siri to say, you know, do you want to write a book with me? And I was very lucky that she said yes, because in the end, the book that we wrote together is not the book that I had originally conceived of. And I think that it's a much better book because we wrote it together.
How do you think it changed from the initial, the inceptive idea?
I think that it's the core of this is the way that Siri and I think differently, but we're compelled by many of the same kinds of questions. And so I'm much more instrumental in the way that I think about, you know, what are the practical policy actions that you can take on the ground, and how is that affected by extreme phenomena, and you know, how do decisions really happen, and so I'm very much grounded in that, you know, somewhat dry, I guess, thinking about the policy as a process, as a decision process, whereas I think Siri brings a much broader, more philosophical, and more wide-ranging set of thoughts and literatures to bring the human into it in a much more tangible way. That's certainly the way I see it. Would you see it that way, Siri?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think you know, one of the things that I was drawn to working with you, just to, you know, take a few steps back. I was hired by Amanda as a postdoc back in 2013, and in the years prior, I'd been doing my PhD in Australia, and I'd gone there to do research on climate change in Northern Australia, coming in very much as a environmental scientist, and being challenged by my supervisor at that time, Richie Howard, very much to look at environmental change, not just from the perspective of science and positivist science, but to look into ontology and epistemology as well. So what sense of being, what sense of experience of being in the world do this community of people I went to visit in Northern Australia, how do they experience that sense of being in the world and the changes that are going on in them? And it was very challenging for me to go and do that, because in that context, the climate change story became one possible explanation for the changes that people were observing in the world around them. And it was one story in the context of, in this particular context, Indigenous Australian worldviews. It was very challenging to kind of put my positivist background, my Western kind of background aside a little bit, and accept and agree that, okay, so this is one plausible story about how the world is changing, and there are many others as well. And in coming to work with Amanda as well, I find it's the way that we work together is that this very productive tension that happens in between that very careful, predictive type of positivist approaches to looking at environmental change and the Anthropocene and so on, and that more constructivist sense of understanding the world and the changes that are going through, the way that people themselves are experiencing them. And I think that productive tension comes out in this book that we've written as well.
Now, I would agree. And as I read it, I thought one of the greatest contributions of the book was particularly bringing together, as you two just put it, the kind of technical policy side of things with these larger questions about epistemology and ontology that we get from writers like Donna Haraway and Bruno Latour. And I think that's a unique aspect of this book and a very productive one. And with what you were just saying, Siri, that kind of leads us into one of the kind of the leading contentions of the book, which is the idea that the Anthropocene is a myth or a certain kind of construction. Can you explain a little bit about what is meant by that in the book?
Do you want to take that one, Amanda?
Sure. One of the fundamental underpinning ideas of the kind of policy analysis that I do is this idea of myth not as a story that is by definition untrue. There's no implication that a myth is necessarily false or factual, people's underlying myths, the stories they tell themselves about the world, or their vision, their worldview, their frame, their narrative, their method, their epistemology. You know, it can be many different things, but it shapes how we view the world. So, in the policy tradition, in the type of analysis that I do, we think about these ideas of myth as a way that people develop expectations about how the world will behave. So there's no expectation that a myth is necessarily the false or true in an empirical sense. It is the frame by which we give the world meaning. And the important thing to understand about the idea of myth is that it is often so deeply accepted by the people who hold that myth as to be unquestioned. And what that means then in the context of climate change is that it limits our ability to envisage other ways of thinking about the problem and thereby other ways of potentially addressing the problem. And so, yeah, so we see this idea of myth as being a way of it's a way that necessarily constrains what we can think about when we think about solutions. But it's also, by addressing it explicitly, it's a way that we can potentially open up the space for new myths and thereby new solutions.
Yes, and so one of the core components of the major myths that we have right now, or conceptions of global warming, is this sense of just unbearable impending urgency. How do you see that as shaping the political possibilities that exist, and what happens if we try to move beyond that?
Siri, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'd like to take a little detour via decolonizing research and decolonizing methodologies as well. When we think about what colonization is all about, it is about imposing a particular kind of myth about who we are and how the world works around us. And, you know, with that myth come doctrines and formulae for how we are expected to interact and behave and the kinds of solutions that come out of that. And certainly one of the great lessons that I've taken out of working in the Indigenous Australian context is just that importance of accepting that, let's say, Western European myth about the Australian context offers one sort of action arena. It's one way of explaining what's going on and one way of envisaging possibilities, possible problems, possible solutions to them. And that if we are to take seriously an agenda of decolonization, it does mean that we have to accept that we're all operating within some a myth to some extent, without saying like Amanda is explaining here, that they're necessarily true or false, but that each of these myths within, we go through them in the book here, Indigenous Australian cosmology and creation myths, Western traditions for origin stories and creation myths and so on. Each of these offer us different possibilities to envisage, what are the problems that we're seeing and what are the solutions that we're willing to accept. And if we're all going to get in line behind one sort of grand narrative of how the world works, we're really going to be repeating the same problems that underpin colonialism. And as part of that as well, there's an argument that it's those Enlightenment epistemologies that to some extent have created the problems that we're trying to solve. And so by accepting this idea of myth, we open up the possibilities for different policy options.
Yeah, so I think when we think about urgency, what that means is that we can recognize that in the context of some worldviews, what's happening right now is deeply unsettling and creates a sense of fear and panic. For other worldviews, it can be interpreted in different ways. And so, you see that in the practical political situations where depending on your politics and where you fall on the political spectrum, you might explain the changes that are happening in different ways and thereby, even determining whether you think it's a problem or not. But we open that out even more broadly and say, if you consider Indigenous ways of thinking where everything is happening in the now, or if you look back at kind of classical ideas of cycles and the fact that there is an ongoing cycle that will always return to the beginning. And so, all of these different myths, whether they be as I guess prosaic as your political orientation or as deep as your ethnic identity, that these things will determine whether you say, first, yes, there's a problem, or no, there isn't. Second, humans have agency to affect the outcome of the problem. And then third, here's a selection of policy alternatives to respond to that problem. And so myth is invoked at every single step of that process.
So we might say that myth is what sort of fills in the gaps, in a sense, right? Where there's uncertainty, we're going to rely on our myths to kind of fill those steps in, to kind of make sense of what's going on. And it's important to be conscious of that, particularly when we have urgency, when there's a foreshortening of time and we need to act now, even more so we tend to sort of focus in on what's familiar, what's known, and to sort of rely on those more familiar and more comfortable explanations that we have. And so while this urgency is necessary for us to act, it's also important to be careful that we're cognizant of the kinds of myths that we're invoking in that urgency, and whether or not they're ultimately the best explanations, I suppose.
Sure. And so in this book, you explain, as one instance of this, is how, the ways that the UN is reacting or responding to climate change evidences certain kinds of myths that are kind of built into the institution and that have developed over the past half a century or so as the UN has changed from a treaty pact into this large governance institution. Can you explain a bit of how you see major myths shaping the UN agreements that have developed in the last 15, 20 years?
Well, certainly I think that what we can really see in the way these agreements are going forward is that the sense of urgency is being invoked explicitly now. You know, since the Paris Agreement, as we note in the book, that the word urgent is used half a dozen times in the Paris Agreement and its preamble. It's not mentioned at all in the Kyoto Protocol or even in the Doha Amendment that extended the Kyoto Protocol, because agreement was not reached in Copenhagen. So there's this sense that that there was, in the early going, because we had successes like the Montreal Protocol and like the World Trade Organization, that there was a sense that our international institutions were up to the task of climate change. But by the time we get to the Paris Agreement, there is this sense that, hang on, we haven't managed to deal with this in the way that we've dealt successfully with these kinds of internationally framed problems in the past. And so there are two ways you can go with that. One is to double down on the international scope and to say, this is still an international thing and it's just urgent and we have to do it and we have to motivate people to action. And the other way is to open up the conversation and say, well, actually, maybe framing this as an irreducibly global problem was not the optimal solution. And so what we're seeing is both of those dynamics playing out, even in the UN, not least, you know, around the world, but even within the UN, you have some components that are doubling down on the global approach and just injecting the sense of urgency and going from 2 degrees to 1.5 degrees. And as a climate scientist, those numbers are kind of meaningless in terms of real impacts. But other parts of the UN are really thinking more about parceling this up into smaller problems that are more tractable and perhaps can be solved through, you know, mini-lateral agreements or even, you know, individual actions within nations.
And how do you see the relationship of this parceling up to to the challenge of responding not just to the technical aspects of climate change and CO2 in the atmosphere, but to the social and matters of environmental justice that shape how people and where people experience the consequences.
You know, I think we're offering up a bit of a critique and a kind of taking a step back a little bit to look at how this evolving myth of the UN has changed since 1948. And I think what we see is that there has been a constant negotiation and questioning and debate about, you know, what is the sort of underpinning myth of the United Nations and its task of, or what has become the task of managing sustainability. You know, looking back at when it was initiated, right, it's the height of modernism and enlightenment and development. And we see over the decades since this evolving attention to how communities manage environmental change, environmental hazards, and so on. And there are, you know, most recently with the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, there is a constant negotiation that's going on that I think is also continuing to evolve. We're talking a bit about some of the limitations of the United Nations myths for things to talk about things like property rights and land tenure. And that, you know, some of the challenges and do lie with those modernist enlightenment style traditions where we are wanting to measure sustainability, we're wanting to measure climate change by this 1 degree, 1.5 degrees, 2 degrees, we're wanting to measure it via GDP and so on, that in a sense we remain somewhat limited by some of those legacies we have from the sort of foundational myths in the United Nations, but it's also somehow the best that we've got at the moment.
Yeah, and I think too that that's where we come to in this idea, which really, you know, I credit Siri with articulating to me in a way that I understood was this idea of coexistence, that we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. I mean, that's the kind of very simplistic way that I think about it, that there are going to be myths that are going to be forever irreconcilable. And yet in that context, we still need to move forward. And so when we're starting to make the link between, you know, this kind of very deeply structured modernist way of thinking about the world and the myths that it was seeking to replace unsuccessfully, the indigenous myths of peoples around the world, that we need to hold those things in tension as we move forward, because it is a matter of urgency. It is becoming a matter of the surviving and thriving of the human human societies and possibly the species. I'm not sure I would go that far, but I certainly wouldn't make any predictions about how this is going to evolve in the future. But what we can see is that we need to be able to hold these irreconcilable myths. We need to hold them in tension, not to seek resolution, but to move forward with you know, a deep acceptance of those differing points of view, and trying to find, and this is where a lot of my work comes from, is trying to find the common ground, trying to find the places where we can move and we can make an impact.
Yeah. And, you know, so part of this, and it's it comes up a few times in the book and is a constant subtext, is the need to think seriously about history. And I'm thinking particularly of the history of colonization. And of course, one of the, you know, sort of bedrock myths of the United Nations is that we're in a post-colonial world and that we've moved on from there.
Right.
And can you tell me a little bit about how you see that reconciliation being important and how it might play out?
Do you want
to? I'll offer some thoughts. I think that one of the real strengths of the United Nations is that it is this deliberative forum where the arena is about negotiating and talking about what is the agenda, what are we doing, and re-articulating that in new ways. And I think in particular this permanent forum for Indigenous issues is one such place where we can just allow the fertile ground for those ideas to come up. Like Amanda's saying, I'm not sure I want to be predicting or previewing, you know, what that's going to be looking like. But I think, that strength of the United Nations is still there, and it still is that deliberative forum. And I think those solutions will be coming up over the coming years.
Well, and I think
thoughts there, Amanda.
Yeah. So I think that there is this one of the quotes that I really like from the book is from Bobby Sykes, who talks about post-colonialism and says, "Have they left?" but I think that realizing that even as we're grappling with this idea that, you know, multilateral and international treaty regimes impinge necessarily on sovereignty, and how you see that is going to be different according to what your personal myth is. At the same time, we have sovereignties in the world that are not recognized at all, that don't have a seat at the table, and that are not part of the negotiation. That said, we are seeing forums in which that kind of multiplicity of overlapping sovereignties is being dealt with in more productive ways. And one of those places is the Arctic, where you do have Arctic Indigenous peoples who are involved very deeply in the policy decisions that are being made by the Arctic nations, and there's no sense that, you know, the Russians or the Canadians are going to leave the Arctic, but at the same time, there's a recognition that there were nations that were there first, and that that have a voice in planning for the Arctic to go forward. So I think we do have models for how this process can go forward, even as the legacy of colonialism is not resolved, and in some cases can't be resolved to any degree that would ultimately be entirely just. And so recognizing that justice is perhaps, you know, just beyond our reach, what can we do that is maybe not going to be exactly what we want, but it's going to be enough? And this comes back to Herb Simon's idea of satisficing. So, you know, how can we get to a place where what we're doing is it's respectful, it acknowledges the tension, And it's enough without being the perfect vision of justice that we might all hope for.
Right. I think that some of the most prominent ideas or that get the most attention around, especially in the public mind around this, is attempts at geoengineering and manifestos like the eco-modernist manifesto I'm thinking about. And in this book, you know, you write that these are based on a certain sort of myth about nature that is particular to the Enlightenment and Western and Western colonization and the forms of settler colonialism that developed over the last 300 years or so. Do you think that can be, well, first of all, can you explain how you see that myth informing these responses and if it can be reconciled or worked through in this process?
Well, I think that, you know, the eco-moderns are really, you know, it's such an interesting thread of thought. That's why we spend so much time on it in the book, because, you know, particularly in the US, you had this very strong and deep tradition of the idea of wilderness and the way that wilderness can, you know, is represents some kind of perfect state. And a lot of that comes out of, you know, romantic ideas of several hundred years ago. But the eco-moderns are really, you know, they're making the observation that, well, if you're going to say that wilderness is perfect without humans and we should fence it off, then the necessary corollary of that is that we need to make spaces for humans to live that are similarly separated from nature and somewhat sacrificial. And while I think that where they take that observation is gets very much into this kind of technological optimism, at the same time, I really credit them with making that clear that you can't have wilderness without having sacrifice zones. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You know, there's one planet. And so the eco-moderns, you know, coming through with this kind of very strong positivist approach to, you know, having technology save us and sacrificing some places for others and indeed sacrificing humans' relationships with the non-human world in order to survive. You know, I think that comes from this very positivist ethos, but it originated in an observation that I think was very accurate. Did you want to add to it, Siri?
I do. You know, one of the things that I found really fascinating that you touched on, Amanda, with the eco-moderns is that it is almost this kind of a manifest destiny type approach, in the sense that it's about talking about a future that is almost just emerging out of will and imagination. There's very little in the way of concrete policy suggestions. They seem to want to avoid that completely. And in so doing, I think, you know, they're stepping outside of what becomes quite muddy, you know, you're getting the devil's in the details, so to speak. And right. Sometimes I wonder if getting too deep into policy and concrete sort of steps can limit the imagination somehow as well. So it's been quite interesting to read up on how these eco-moderns think, and some of the solutions that are coming out of those circles are quite intriguing. And then, like Amanda's saying, there's then the challenge of, you know, where will these lines be drawn? And, you know, where's the human space and where is the natural space? And that brings up some very awkward and kind of fragile situations. You know, an example also from the Arctic is the reintroduction of carnivores into northern Norway, for instance, where reindeer herders are moving their flocks around. And because of these large predators being brought back in, wanting to naturalize these environments, they're predating the reindeer. But since the reindeer is supposed to be a domestic human stock, they should be kept apart. And so they've been instructed to put up fences to keep the reindeer safe from the predators, which of course doesn't work. but the intention's there, and it's somehow where the rubber meets the road, that where the issues seem to come up with these eco-modern approaches. To some extent, if we want to touch on the California fires that are ongoing as well, right, is that we, part of this wilderness myth, the idea of sort of living in these semi sort of wild areas where there's forest surrounding, and there's an ideal of living in those places and retiring in those places where, you know, old methods of fire or fire management are done to a very limited degree, and you end up with these catastrophic fires for multiple and complex reasons, but that take people by surprise. And to some extent, you know, that arises also from this idea of being able to be human within this, you know, untouched wilderness somehow. So it was interesting for us to take a bit of a deep dive into eco-modernism, and like I said, there's a lot of seemingly useful and fruitful ideas there, and some of the challenges are, well, how does that work in praxis, and a lot of the time, yeah, it does require these sacrifice zones,
right, and governance institutions that can create this, compel people to participate in this separation of humans and this pure idea of nature.
Which yeah. I think, you know, that immediately invokes this idea of human dignity, and, you know, to what extent is it even appropriate to think about, you know, that kind of authoritarian approach to dealing with the problem.
Sure. You know, so one way that you describe in the book this eco-modernist approach is this notion of decoupling from nature, and this is a, you know, a long-standing Enlightenment idea that humans are becoming more and more separated from nature, and we can continue this path, and by doing so, we preserve both of us. And I think that there's an opposite opposing myth that that's an impossibility, that humans are always part of nature. In fact, we're only becoming more and more integrated as we develop more and more technologies. And these seem just to be completely opposed ideas about the basic ontology of the world. Do you think that both of them can be functional in this idea of coexistence that you have?
Yeah, it is a good question. I mean, I think that for me personally, the idea of decoupling from nature completely seems not entirely possible. I mean, I think that, as Siri said, the devil's in the details, and I think that, you know, we're going to kind of get whacked every time by the fact that we're, you know, material beings living in a material universe. But at the same time, I think, you know, as I said, that this idea of decoupling and the fact that an ideal of wilderness actually invokes decoupling, even though it doesn't get talked about a lot, means that we do need to think about, well, you know, are there going to be situations where that's important? And, you know, you even have to start thinking about it when you start thinking about going off planet, which is, you know, something that there are people working on and preparing for. You know, that is the ultimate decoupling. And so I think that, you know, with all of these kinds of myths, you know, be it the eco-moderns or the wilderness myth or, you know, the ways of knowing that are among Inuit or Australian Indigenous people or, you know, the ancient Greeks, that with all of these things, the myths, engaging with the myths is largely about opening your mind to the possibilities. And so rather than rejecting those myths out of hand, and so, you know, in the spirit of coexistence, what I would say is I wouldn't reject decoupling out of hand. I do see some issues with it as a practical policy alternative, but at the same time, it does enable us to think about some of these very complex kind of responses like off-planet settlements or, you know, extreme urbanization.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think also that, you know, the idea of decoupling for the eco-moderns means something quite different to how the United Nations talks about it and operationalizes the idea of decoupling. And in a sense, it's a means of closing a certain production. So we can think about plastics, we can think about metals, perhaps fabrics that, you know, and closing a resource cycle so that it doesn't have spill on environmental impacts outside of that closed loop system. And I think, you know, as a kind of formula that's probably feasible, when it becomes a myth for how humans should relate to or do relate to the environment, I think that's more where the troubles come up, and that's where we get those issues of, well, if we're, you know, and I'm thinking of Eva Wilson's Half Earth here also, you know, there are specific narrations of what that decoupled planet looks like. And I think that's where I agree. I have a much harder time seeing that panning out as a realistic sort of goal, or even a goal that we should want to aim for.
Just to be clear for listeners, you were talking about E.O. Wilson's idea of the half Earth, right?
Half Earth. Yeah. Yes.
Just to have that clear. So this covers my questions for you. Are there any aspects of this book that I've neglected to ask you about that you want to make sure are included here?
Well, I did want to mention one thing in terms of creation myths. And, you know, in coming up with the idea for the book as well, I remember it a little differently. It doesn't mean that it's not true. And I think, you know, in a sense, it's sort of an illustration of what it is we're trying to say, right?
Absolutely.
We have different ways of remembering and understanding and sort of projecting, and it's highly subjective and situational. You know, I remember Amanda being visited by the editor and saying, hey, would you like to write a book? And us sitting down making flowcharts and think maps, you know, to sort of map out, you know, how and where do our ideas sort of gel, you know, how can we start to articulate a book draft? And I found that process to be just incredibly interesting and stimulating as well. And, you know, we did that groundwork, and I think it created a type of structure that enabled us to just have kind of an agreement of the kinds of concepts and terms that we wanted to talk about, and you know, having that sort of common discourse of, you know, the hooks that we're wanting to hang our analysis on was really helpful and really aided us in writing what I think's become, you know, a decently readable book. So
I guess the other piece that I wanted to think about, well, first off, I do want to say, I mean, I think that both of our creation stories of the book are true, just kind of emphasize different things, and so it is a really nice illustration of this this idea of myth. The other element of the book that I wanted to highlight was this particular issue of extremes, and that's something that I think is very very often seen as a motivator for policy, this idea that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste, and so if you have a hurricane or a typhoon, or you have a fire, or you have a drought, that these kinds of extremes tend to be where we're really confronted by our ideas and our myths around our relationship with the non-human world. And one of the things I think that is a really interesting future path to think about is how that discourse around extremes is influencing the policy responses. Because I know that, you know, back when Hurricane Katrina happened, all of us in the climate community thought, right, this is it. Everyone's going to act on climate change now because Katrina was just so devastating and nothing happened. And then we had a disaster after that and a disaster after that. And so this idea that somehow weather disasters linked to climate or not are a stimulus for policy in climate change, that is an area that seems to be not as coupled as we may have thought, you know, in 10 or 15 years ago. So what's really interesting about that is the science is starting to kind of catch up with that idea, where the idea of being able to attribute extreme weather events to climate change in particular ways, that science is becoming more mature. And so what's going to be interesting in the future, I think, is whether that idea that crises will prompt policy responses, whether that's going to come back into focus as the science catches up with the idea.
Right. And you know, we spend some time in the book also cautioning a little bit to equate that ability to detect and measure an extreme event with the ability to muster a response that's up to the task, mm-hmm. in a sense, and cautioning a little bit that we don't. And I think Typhoon Haiyan was a good example of that. You know, where it really was a case study in excellent preparation for extreme events, but the event became so much greater than what was expected. It became a confluence of factors that made it a much greater disaster than what they had even prepared for. And so we found it was not enough. So we do spend some time in the book just reminding ourselves of not getting too caught up in the measurements and sort of quantification of the changes and paying equal attention to the ways that we prepare ourselves for those events.
Yeah.
I think I had one final point that I wanted to bring up as well. It speaks back to this sort of underlying theme of colonization and decolonization as well, is that, you know, this Anthropocene narrative of sort of apocalypse by our own hands, in a sense, it's the science, it's the Enlightenment story, kind of arriving at its own eschatology, in a sense, right? It's when you look at myths that explain the world, these cosmological myths, they usually have an origin story and they have an ending story, they have an eschatology. And here, in a sense, is the Enlightenment story that's come full circle, and it now also has an account for the ending of the world. And it's scary, and it's sort of that's what's bringing about this urgency. But it's also important to remember that for peoples across the world, the world has ended many times already. You know, the thing about, you know, white sails on the horizon and so on. It's happened many times, and this particular time it's different, but there are lessons we can draw also from how people have managed these apocalyptic changes in the past, if we can take the time to listen to others.
Yeah, I find that an especially inspiring note in the book, especially as you say, the culmination of the Enlightenment narrative for us now is either, you know, disaster or salvation from technology, and there doesn't seem to be that a gray zone as much. So, well, thank you so much. So, what are you two working on now, individually or together?
Well, we're still working together, actually, and Siri is taking the lead we're getting much more specific, I guess, getting back to case studies, which is where our insights ultimately come from in the North Atlantic. So, Siri, why don't you talk about that?
Sure. So we have a collaboration ongoing. We've got some funding from the National Science Foundation, where we're looking at human environment interactions in the North Barents Sea and in the Svalbard area. It's also a highly interdisciplinary effort. I think it's going to be continuing a lot of the same productive tensions that have benefited us so far. We'll be developing models for sea ice and ship traffic, and considering how people who make planning decisions in the Arctic make sense of risks and how they devise policy to manage those. Yeah, so that's what's next.
Yeah, well, on the agenda. I look forward to that. I hope to talk to you when that one comes out then too.
Right.
Right.
Well, thank you so much for your time, and
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks very much.